Welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today, a little later in the show, we're going to be talking a lot about foreign policy, and then for a good chunk of our early segments about some of the issues still emanating and eddying out of the Philando Castile shooting and some other news of note in relation. But before we can move on, well, we mentioned to you yesterday and what I thought might be a one-day story that Donald Trump's pledge to renew the manufacturing base of America wasn't off to a great start, and that the auto industry in particular was shedding a notable number of jobs and failing to replace them as the growth in that industry started to stall. We also noted how Ford, in a slap in the face to the Trump administration, decided to move production of their new Ford Focus to China after President Trump had criticized them for originally saying they were going to move it to Mexico. Well, as corporate layoffs that make Donald Trump look bad go, Boeing may have just exceeded Ford. In February, to highlight his jobs push, quote-unquote, Trump went to a Boeing plant in South Carolina. He told the crowd in North Charleston, which, by the way, same city where Walter Scott was murdered by killer cop Michael Slager. He told the crowd, quote, jobs is one of the primary reasons I'm standing here today as your president, and I will never, ever disappoint you. Believe me, I will not disappoint you, close quote. Well, Boeing just announced that at that very factory, they will now be laying off 200 people. This, in fact, is not that surprising, actually, because Boeing announced in December it was going to cut many jobs, and they have. In the past 12 months, they've laid off 9% of their workforce, or 13,000 people, because of pretty stiff competition from other companies over a now dwindling demand for new planes after a big major push over the past decade or so, particularly by many national carriers looking to scale up. And believe it or not, Boeing has actually sent a memo to workers in South Carolina saying there could still be more cuts. But that's not all. Remember that Carrier plant in Indiana where Trump allegedly struck a deal to save people's jobs? Well, yesterday, Carrier announced that on July 20th, 338 workers will be laid off. And that in December of this year, an additional 290 jobs are set to be cut at the plant. So it looks like Trump, who says he's the greatest deal maker in the world and his so-called brilliant business minds, aren't really doing much of anything to revive manufacturing, which of course is not a surprise. That was never their goal. They are interested in eviscerating all regulations and conducting a massive transfer of wealth, probably in the trillions of dollars, to the super wealthy through so-called tax reform. The entire Trump presidency is really just a firebombing raid on working class and oppressed people, all the better to rebuild those communities in the image of totally wanton, unregulated, bloodthirsty, brutal capitalist profiteering, wringing every last drop of blood from the stone as the world is literally destroyed around humanity. In the wake of the Grenfell fire, many have noted how the Grenfell Action Group had been warning literally for years that this could happen. The government is now testing 600 buildings to see if they are similarly combustible, and so far have found seven that are indeed similarly combustible. Now, of course, Theresa May and her ministers are acting very self-righteously about a problem they didn't care about until dozens were immolated in the burning apartment block in Grenfell. On a deeper level, one has to ask, what did the government think of the Grenfell Action Group? Did they just ignore them simply because they're callous, or is it more insidious than that? Was the real issue not so much the housing, but that the action group was exposing the shoddy construction and callous landlords that the government has allowed to run amok? I raise the issue primarily because the government in the UK, along with big major corporations there, have a very long history, an interlocking history indeed, of criminalizing and spying on activists who try to raise health and safety issues, among other things. For instance, there are 3,200 construction workers who were blacklisted in the UK for raising health and safety concerns, many of them losing works for years because of it. The blacklist campaign collected all sorts of information, not just on construction workers, but on firefighters, postal workers, and other progressive unionists, and put it in an overall blacklist file that was circulated around a number of the largest construction companies in the UK. And a number of those firms are actually docked in court and are on the hook for millions of pounds in damages. Corporate espionage groups have also been caught doing surveillance on anti-asbestos campaigners as well, and the Metropolitan Police were caught spying on the RMT Transit Union. And that undercover cop was part of something called the Special Demonstration Squad that the Metropolitan Police there had. SDS would adopt elaborate cover identities going deep, deep undercover and over 40 years infiltrating hundreds of different political groups, which included, starting in the 1980s and continuing until 2005, surveilling the families of police violence in the UK who were fighting totally lawfully for justice in the cases of their loved ones. And this has become, in the past 4 or 5 years, a larger issue as the lid has been lifted off of some of the UK government's principal tactics in these infiltrations, one of which was to have its undercover officers form sexual relationships with members of campaigning groups, in one case even fathering a child. 9 of the 11 officers that were publicly identified in one 2013 inquiry had sexual relationships with their targets. One, Mark Jenner, was explicitly sent in to target groups working on environmental issues. The revelations have brought to the forefront numerous women who were victimized by these undercover officers, who have told heartbreaking stories of falling in love only to have their partners simply just disappear one day. The United Kingdom, which lacks formal constitutional protections like our Bill of Rights, is well known for being a society where spies have almost a complete free reign. There's a complex web of institutions linked to the special branch and MI5 that for decades have maintained a massive system of surveillance over protest groups of all kinds, socialist parties, and campaigners for an independent Ireland. It hasn't mattered at all whether the activities were legal or not. As a former Home Secretary once noted, the existence of all these groups was to, quote, to collect information on those who I think cause problems for the state, end quote. And that is to say, regardless of the legality or ethics, to infiltrate, surveil, and establish the capacity to disrupt any group critical of the actions of the British state. So we should start asking now, and loudly, how much the government knew about what the Grenfell Action Group was doing and what they did in response to the information they gathered. In the 2000 election, Ralph Nader made a very famous statement about the two major parties. He said, quote, there isn't a dime's worth of difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. After the 2000 election, Nader was savaged for this statement by very angry Gore supporters who erroneously stated he had cost Gore the election. Nader's statement, however, is broadly true. The two parties are essentially two different wings of one party of elite super-rich people. Dialogue takes place within certain boundaries, and there are also certain red lines outside of which debate doesn't go. And at its heart, the same set of corporate elites who attend the same parties and the same clubs and have the same interest are the funding backbone of both parties. And that latter fact is now on grotesque display as we see a number of Hillary Clinton's most prominent financial backers reappear as lobbyists for the Trump agenda. Yes, that's right. A number of high-level Democrats are now lobbying on behalf of major priorities for the Trump administration. Al Motor, who raised $95,000 and some change for the Clinton campaign, is now lobbying for the National Cable and Telecommunications Association, aiding their push to end net neutrality, which requires them to treat all websites equally and not force companies to pay to access faster speeds, which, of course, is crucial because without it, the Internet turns into a series of toll roads. All those who are – and only those who are deemed legitimate and who can afford to pay will be able to access the Internet at speeds that would make them viable. No net neutrality means total control of what you see, watch, and read online will be handed over to the AT&Ts and Comcast of the world, which doesn't bother Motor, the Hillary donor, who tweeted out his support of eliminating net neutrality not long after FCC Chair Ajit Pai started the process of rolling it back. Heather Podesta. Yes, one of those Podestas brought about $407,000 into the Clintons' coffers, and who claims to be down with the quote-unquote resistance is also a big lobbyist for some things Trump also loves. Podesta, according to The Intercept, said her New Year's resolution was to, quote, make lobbying great again. She's done her part by expanding her firm to bring in more folks with ties to Trump, and on top of that, she's gone to bat for big insurance companies like Prudential as they try to stop the, quote, fiduciary rule. Now, that was a very simple rule that the Obama administration tried to put in towards the end of his second term, and it requires that financial advisors work in the best interest of their client, something that previously they had not been legally required to do. Now, of course, no financial planner really wants that because they want to be able to steer you into risky investments that could make them a lot of money, even if at the end of the day it screws you. So now, Heather Podesta, big supporter of Hillary Clinton, now lobbying Congress to keep the rule from going into effect. And she's not alone. Steve Elmendorf, who rounded up about $341,000 for Clinton, is working for Prudential's trade group, the Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association. Woo. Also trying to stop the fiduciary rule. And here's the real kicker, and very relevant given the recent information about Hillary Clinton's run in there in the governor's mansion with inmates. Richard Sullivan raised $345,128 for Clinton and has been a big DNC fundraiser since President Clinton was in office, is now a lobbyist for Geo Group. Yes, that's the private prison company, Geo Group. What's he been doing for them? Well, he's trying to convince lawmakers of the, quote, benefits of public-private partnerships in the delivery of secure residential care and correctional and detention facilities. So there you have it. There isn't a dime's worth of difference between the Democrats and the Republicans as it concerns a lot of their big funders. And those are today's talking points. You are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perger, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we are very happy to be joined as we continue our conversation here by Marcus Farrell, who's a political strategist, organizer, and the former African-American outreach director for Bernie Sanders. Michael Harriet, who's a critically acclaimed poet, journalist, novelist, broadcaster, and the editor-in-chief of Negus Who Read. And Dr. David Ragland, who's a peace and conflict resolution scholar and part of the Truth Telling Project in Ferguson. Gentlemen, thank you all so much for being with us again.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
And I wanted to start here with an issue that I'm sure we've all been talking a lot about this week, but I want to keep talking about it because I think it just says so much about so many things, and that is the Philando Castile getting zero justice, Geronimo Yanez, the officer who killed him, being let off. And Michael, I want to start with you here. I know you had a recent piece about this, and I mean, it really seems, the way I sort of structured this one when I talked to people about it is I said, you know, whatever people think about quote-unquote respectability politics, you know, certainly Philando Castile sort of fit all those boxes. And the fact that he could still be murdered and the guy just walk away, you know, really was a slap in the face to anyone saying that black life in America is valued. But your thoughts upon hearing that Officer Yanez was being let go?
Right. I think it's indicative of the narrative that, you know, like you said, respectability politics, where there's something that black men or black women can do to stop themselves from being killed by the police. You know, I think Eric Garner was an example of that. And every now and then we have an example of that. And Philando Castile is one. He didn't commit any crime. He did exactly what the police officer told him to do. Yet he was still shot at point blank range. And I wrote about if, you know, he had a legal gun. The NRA hasn't come forward. And I said, well, if he was shot for having a gun legally, right, then that means a black man shouldn't have a gun. And if a black man can't enjoy one of his constitutional rights, then a black man has no constitutional rights. And one can be removed from you simply by threat from law enforcement officers, then you don't have any of them. And so those are the things that ran through my head when I heard about the verdict of Philando Castile.
Mm. Well, Dave Ragland, I'll turn to you, and I think perhaps shades of your previous experiences here, Dr. Ragland, in Ferguson, seeing this guy be let off. But your thoughts on the Yanez-Castile situation?
And, you know, my thoughts are very similar to Brother Michael because My thought was that we never had those rights, and we constantly see a barrage of black folks, gun or not, being targeted by police. Even black police officers, for instance, are often drawn on and attacked when they pull out their weapons. And this is a historical precedent where, you know, black folks, it was illegal for us to have guns, even after slavery or assembling and things like that. And I think it's just indicative of our experience, black folks here in this country, number one, not being afforded the right to have a gun. And this entire society, the U.S., was created under the use of guns and violence. And so black folks have historically tried to serve our country in the military and in police departments to feel as if we were more American. But that right to use violence, which is core to this country, has never been afforded to us and always used against us.
Marcus Farrell, I turn to you. Your thoughts on the lack of justice for Philando Castile.
You know, we are in the day and age of this resistance movement. And all of these folks who are calling us out to march with them to resist Trump, it's just disappointing that I don't see policies from these same mouths that will force the conversation in state houses across the country that make sure that African Americans are protected at the same rate that white Americans are when it comes down to violence against black men and when coming from the police department. My thoughts are very simple and very blatant. Until we start seeing policy, you can miss me at your next march. I'm done with it. I want to see these elected officials that we put into office and spend $30 million on a race have a platform that actually says something about addressing the atrocities of the current criminal justice system. Until that happens, I can no longer condone any candidate asking for my vote.
Well, I think it's a good point, Marcus, and let me ask you this follow-up, is that to some degree, can it be more harmful in some ways for these people to make these? I mean, you think Mark Dayton, the governor who came out and said there's going to be justice in this case and it wouldn't have happened if he was black. Al Franken, who put out a statement after it was over, saying, oh, this is such a tragic thing. But it's like, you're the governor and a senator. I don't really care if you think it's tragic. What are you going to do about it? And that, I didn't hear from them at all.
Right. Well, I mean, I'm tired of them talking to us in a reactionary fashion. Every single year, every single month, it seems like every other week a black man is killed or a cop gets off. At what point do they become assertive in their justice and their comments? And when the limelight is away, they actually take up the mantle of fighting for justice and creating policy that holds police officers accountable. It's easy to say it when it's the trending topic on Twitter or when a viral video comes out of a black man getting killed. The hard work is when those cameras aren't on and social media is not present.
You know, Michael, I think this is a good question about the whole issue of quote-unquote accountability, too, because in a system like the one we have where police basically police themselves, I've been thinking more and more that accountability is kind of a tricky concept just because since the police seem to not feel, you know, looking, for example, at this guy, the cop who kicked the guy in the head, you know, kicked his head down into the concrete so hard it bounced back up, and the police chief in that city saying, oh, he only deserves a one-day suspension. And it's like, how can you really have real accountability when the police don't even think they've done anything wrong?
And the big thing is the court system, you know, they're not held responsible by a court system because that court system is really their teammates. When you think about the everyday work of a police officer, they work hand in hand with prosecutors, with judges. And so I don't understand how we think this is an impartial system that'll ever find them guilty of any crime, right? You know, I did an article a couple of days ago that just looked at the raw data, and it found that in the last 13 years, since 2005, only 5 police officers have been found guilty of killing an African-American person, and that is out of 13,000 people who have been killed over that time, only 5 police officers. And it's debatable whether the number is 5 because 2 of those weren't sworn police officers. And so so I don't understand how we think it's ever going to happen without a change in the actual rules and the system that tries police officers because they're being tried by their teammates, by their family.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's a very, very good point. I mean, obviously, if the standard for a shooting, and for our listeners, if you don't know, that's the Supreme Court set up is an officer, is it reasonable? Would a reasonable officer have feared for their life? And given, you know, the mentality of police officers, what's reasonable and what's not is debatable. But either way, we're going to take a break. We're going to come back with more with all of our guests here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And we are continuing our conversation here on this Friday with Marcus Farrell, who's a political strategist, organizer, and former African-American outreach director for Bernie Sanders, Michael Harriott, who's a critically acclaimed poet, journalist, novelist, broadcaster, and the editor-in-chief of Negus Who Read, and then Dr. David Raglan, peace and conflict resolution scholar and part of the Truth-Telling Project in Ferguson. And Dr. Raglan, I want to come back to you here on sort of a related issue. It looks like, and many people saw that there was a settlement between the city of Ferguson and Michael Brown's family. I'm seeing now that it looks like originally the number was undisclosed. Now it looks like it's $1.5 million. And in so many of these cases, the officers get off, and then on a civil trial, the cities or whoever is responsible pays off this huge amount of money to the families. I mean, I think the families deserve whatever they get, but it really does have this kind of blood money feel that, I don't know, just it seems unsavory to me. But your thoughts, Dave Raglan, coming out of Ferguson especially.
I think that this is an important topic. And, I spoke with some of the family members recently, and, I don't think it's enough, especially when you consider the way that the family members have been trotted out in front of the media and treated badly and taken advantage of by so many different parties who are just concerned about, well, this is popular in the media. But this also speaks to how people who are killed by police are often, their names are exploited or run down, and no one's talking about, the money that Darren Wilson got from, all of those folks who are supporting him. I don't know if anybody's been to the Blue Lives Matter website, but they're raising all kinds of funds for police. And, if you even look into the comments that those folks are making, they're often racist and vitriolic, and they have nothing to do with supporting people. And I think this goes back to the previous conversation around police officers who are always let off and politicians who don't care. But when you think about most politicians, mainstream politicians, when they're running for office, one thing they promise is more police. And so I think that the focus is increasing this militarized policing and policing in our society as an answer to all of our problems, when it doesn't answer any of the problems like housing, employment, fair income, and all of these things that we're dealing with in our communities.
Well, Michael, I'm curious your thoughts on this same piece, the sort of blood money piece. I mean, I guess in some ways I'm of two minds. I mean, one, I think, again, like I said before, the families deserve whatever they can get. And I think I don't want to be culturally relative about it, but there are cultures, for example, parts of Pakistan and Afghanistan, where this is a regular practice. When you've wronged someone, you pay them as a recognition of the wrong and the harm that you've done. But I don't know. It still leaves kind of a bad taste in my mouth seeing that this is what they get. I mean, it's like, hey, we're not going to do anything to the person who we admit killed your son wrongfully, but hey, here's $1 million. But your thoughts, Michael Harriott.
I always have to remind people when we talk about these settlements is that the cops or even the police department aren't paying these settlements. It's coming from the citizens of Ferguson, right? So a police officer, a lone police officer killed Mike Brown, and the citizens of Ferguson basically are giving the family that $1.5 million, not Darren Wilson, not the police department. It is the citizens of Ferguson. And so, when we talk about recompense, the city doesn't really, or the officer doesn't really, ever have to pay anything. That money is, Darren Wilson is covered under the badge of the law. So they're never found guilty and made to personally pay. So we always have to remember where that money comes from. And the second thing is, if someone came up to you, I don't know if any of you guys are parents, but if someone asked you today, right now, would you give $1.5 million and let me kill your child? What would your answer be? So that money is never going to balance the scales of what happened to Mike Brown's family.
Marcus Farrell, your thoughts on this issue. We've seen so many of these payouts over the years, some cities even getting in financial trouble like L.A. Because they have so many of them. Form of justice, no justice at all. Your thoughts?
Republican Party would be more in tune with these issues. But the GOP And I'm not going to just say the GOP, but our elected officials in general are just showing a great level of anti-blackness. When it comes down to Philando, you know, the NRA hasn't said a word about him being a, you know, a registered gun owner and basically getting shot because he did more than his legal duty. When it comes down to physical responsibility and citizens having to pay out these huge payouts, to family members of deceased black men, you figure the Republican Party would actually be all over this issue and say and fight against these police shootings out of a physical responsibility issues. But look at the victim. The victims are black men. Probably not their voting base, probably not their donor base. That's why we don't get much traction on our issues that normally good government would be taken care of. If we consider ourselves in a country that has good government would be the first folks that are fighting against, African Americans getting shot, unarmed men getting shot. And it's just a travesty.
Well, I want to switch gears here and talk about another issue, that I view as a travesty, and that is this post-acquittal Bill Cosby tour of the country that I guess is maybe happening, maybe not happening. For those who haven't heard, allegedly Bill Cosby is going to be traveling the country speaking to young athletes and perhaps their families as well about how to not get accused of sexual assault. And so, I mean, there's a lot here. Michael Harriet, editor-in-chief of Negus Who Read, your thoughts on Bill Cosby's comeback tour here?
Well, first, I want to say that I want to go outside and I want to go on the tour and just stand outside wherever the venues are and just see who's going in to listen to Bill Cosby talk about how not to get accused of rape, because they should arrest those guys, right? Like, if you're paying whatever Bill Cosby's charging to figure out how to get out of a rape charge, you know, you need to be looked at a little bit. And the second thing is, like, they announced this, but I don't know who's going to come. And these things highlight the seriousness of how we treat rape and sexual assault, that, like, we think we need to have this big, huge conversation. I could have a conversation right now to every man about how to get out of a rape charge right now. It takes 2 seconds. Don't rape anyone. That's it. That's all you need to do.
Yeah, you would think very simple, wouldn't require a lot. Marcus Farrell, I don't know how much you've seen this or thought about this. I mean, it really just is, to me, shocking and unbelievable. The spokesperson for Cosby said, oh, we've gotten hundreds of calls. I don't even know if I believe that, but from organizations that want to come hear him speak. I mean, it really is just shocking on so many different levels. Your thoughts?
You know, he needs to sit down while he's ahead. If he just does, he's pushing his luck, and you know, and I hear the grand conspiracy theory a lot that the powers that be had it out for Cosby for trying to buy NBC. You know, that might be true, that might not be true, but he just had multiple women accuse him of rape, and he just got a mistrial. He needs to just go somewhere and sit down. And all the sarcastic hey-hey-hey's that he's doing, leaving the courtroom, that needs to stop. I mean, win while you're ahead and go ahead and just go right off into the sunset while you can. That's my thoughts.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you referenced that. For those who didn't hear, on his way out of the courthouse, Bill Cosby did the old Fat Albert on his way out to celebrate his victory, and then took a photo with Keisha Knight Pulliam, the former Rudy of the Cosby Show, and, I don't know, referenced himself in the third person as Cliff Huxtable. It was very strange on so many different levels, but trying to remember folks. You know, Dave Ragland, I'm curious your thoughts on this, and one other wrinkle I'll throw in here. I don't know how true this is, but I saw an article that said that a lot of these black television channels like Centric, I guess, and the other ones started running more reruns of The Cosby Show during the trial. And who knows, maybe they were just trying to get some money because people are thinking about Bill Cosby and would watch. But then I also thought, like, I don't know about that. But anyway, your general thoughts on the comeback tour, the trial, black television, whatever grabs you.
Well, I mean, I think it's sickening. I think that one of the issues that black folks we don't deal with is misogyny in our communities and violence against women. And, you know, part of the movement for Black Lives, women are describing and talking about that violence that often happens against them. And we don't discuss it. We don't deal with it enough. We don't try to remove ourselves and figure out how to be supporters of women. And I know Angela Davis in her book, Freedom is a Constant Struggle, described how at one point in Oakland, there was a group of black men who were against rape. And I think that black men especially have to come out and support those kind of efforts to eradicate misogyny and violence against women. And I think broadly speaking, you know, this society has a lot of tolerance for rapists and violence against women. You know, this is a country that began where women, including black folks and, you know, for the most part, black folks were not considered human. And no one talks about not just the rape of black women, but the rape of men as black men during slavery and Jim Crow as a way to intimidate and control black folks. And so, you know, I think Cosby needs to sit down and shut up and get some help and figure out how not to be a misogynist. You know, it's just, it's very troubling. It's very troubling. And I applaud the efforts of organizations like Black Women's Blueprint, who are working around that violence, that intergenerational trauma that comes from this history. But not just that, like, I think as a people, sometimes we don't delve deep enough into this violence against women, particularly because of white supremacy, because of structural racism that so often tries to emasculate black men. And so, you know, sometimes I think it is harmful of those networks, you know, people of color networks that are actually playing into that. And, you know, we just have to figure out how do we take a stand against this, no matter who the person is. And, it, you know, I've been thinking during this, I've been thinking about how, for instance, that white kid, I think he was a swimmer who raped this college student. You know, like the judge, right, the Stanford guy who got let off, you know, I think because the judge was worried about how prison would affect him. And, you know, like I've been personally supporting women who were sexually assaulted, you know, protesters and people on college campuses. And as a former faculty member at one college, I remember another faculty member, I don't know if people know the numbers, but on college campuses, the number is, I think, 2 out of 5 women are sexually assaulted. And on this college campus, the number was even higher. And the professor who found that in his research, they tried to deny him tenure. And I think the same question goes that one of the folks on this panel mentioned was that, would you be willing to pay or accept payment if someone raped your child? And the question is no. Like, it's, we have to cease that violence too, which ends folks' lives.
No, I think that's a very a good point on a lot of different levels. And I mean, you know, to swing back to a point you made earlier too, Marcus, about the NRA, I mean, I was thinking about Charlena Lyles, who was killed in Seattle, and the first time the police had gone to her house, you know, they had said, oh, well, she was armed, but she had said, well, I was armed against a, you know, an abusive boyfriend. Certainly we saw Marissa Alexander as well defend herself. And it really does seem that there is a double standard for black women defending themselves in the case of domestic violence. And a lot of times, you know, that is a part and parcel of why they're criminalized and killed by police.
I did direct organizing for Marissa down in Jacksonville. And I saw that case up and down. And what I found was almost the community-wide acceptance that stand your ground only works unless you are only works for white men. Even black men in Jacksonville were against her when it came down to her shooting a gun in the air to basically send off a warning shot that, hey, I will protect myself and I will protect my family. You know, we as black men, and I'm not going to be on the black men back our bad thing, but I will say this. We have to go out of our way to protect our sisters, like we would our mothers and like we would our wives, and protect them and believe them first before anyone else does. There is a segment of classical white feminism that I'm not going to go into too deeply, but that actually separates us from our black women because we allow narratives that basically people outside of our race create about what we are instead of defending, protecting, and loving our sisters as much as we possibly can. That makes a deep divide. And in situations like Marissa, where, you know, she needed activists and female and family members and females across the city of Jacksonville to just stand up for her and be the first one to actually, like, go out and protest on her behalf. And I didn't see many black men, many black clergy, because there's an acceptance that, you know, black women particularly can't take care of themselves and can't defend themselves and also are not believable when they say they're getting raped, when they say they're getting abused. And that just has to change across the board within our society.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a great point there. You know, I want to just switch gears to one more thing that I think is just an interesting story. It was actually the writing of Michael Harriet that brought it to my attention. And that was this young guy, Tyreek Smith, who's a high school junior. He's a Ohio State prospect. He wore a shirt to, his workout at Ohio State or his visit that said, "I hope I don't get killed for being black today." Of course, he was photographed, so it's going around the internet. I thought, great shirt. I thought, great conversation starter. Let me ask you this, Michael. I mean, I have to say, you know, Colin Kaepernick, I don't know if we are appreciating him as much as we should, because the thing I liked about this shirt is I thought it punctured two myths. I mean, one, it was, you know, sort of going along with sports stars using their platform, but also showing that a lot of these young guys who are great athletes are not all idiots the way they're portrayed. I mean, probably most of them are not, but certainly, you know, it's like if you're an athlete going to a place like Ohio State, everyone assumes you must be dumb, you must not know anything, you never could have made it on yourself. But obviously, this young man is doing a lot of thinking and a lot of critical questioning. And I liked what he did with the shirt there, and I thought that really it just made me really appreciate Kaepernick again for launching the challenge that I think is really responsible for this whole new climate in sports. But your thought?
Yeah, I always think that platforms like this and what Colin Kaepernick did are important because they increase awareness, right? So even like people say, well, what Colin Kaepernick did, how will that affect police violence? And it might not. It probably won't because nothing else has. Video doesn't do it. But the awareness of this issue, especially amongst young people, is important, right? Because when you take this young man at Ohio State, he is a 4-star defensive end and that's ranked out of the entire country, one of the most wanted athletes in the country as a junior in high school. And he's big and he's powerful and he's strong. So he's aware that of the place that he holds in society and how society views him, right? You know, we know that there was a study published last year that black men are viewed as bigger, stronger, and more athletic than white men who are the same size. And you talk about someone like this guy who's bigger than the average person, it's not like people like to think, especially white people like to think that we come from a place of anger when it's a place of desperation. He hopes that he's not killed for being black today. You know, when you see these protests, when they think like Black Lives Matter is an angry organization, no, they're desperate. They you know, that desperation manifests itself in so many ways, and you might think it comes from anger because the voices are so loud, but what it is trying to preserve the lives of our children and our nephews and our nieces and our fathers and our sons and our mothers and our daughters. And that's why I love the idea that he, on his biggest platform, right, one of the biggest college programs in America, on that day when he got to visit that college, he chose to say something. And I think that's really important and it's really admirable.
May I just say, I want to just say this real quick. When a brother wears a shirt that says, "I hope I don't get killed for being black today," and that goes viral in this environment, and something's wrong with the environment. because we know it honestly. We honestly know that we are getting killed, that it goes viral every single week. So just think about what got famous about that. That brother told his truth that all black men in America think every day, and yet it's almost a controversy. Interesting stuff.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. That's a great point. We're going to have to leave it there. Unfortunately, a lot to be said about all of these topics, and certainly if you keep listening to hear, By Any Means Necessary, you'll hear all these gentlemen again. We're going to take another break. We're going to come back with more here on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we're going to end the week here talking a little bit about some of the continued issues roiling around the world and U.S. relationships to it. And we're very happy to be joined for this conversation by John Pfeffer, who is an author and the co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. John, thank you so much for being with us again.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Of course. So I wanted to start here on a slightly more esoteric note because we haven't actually chatted since the election in the UK. And you know, one thing to me that was very interesting about the way that played out that, I don't think got a lot of credit in the media for, I think, making a difference. But nevertheless, I thought it was relevant, especially to the way, quote unquote, progressive politics is in America, was after all of the terrorist attacks, the success Corbyn seemed to have by highlighting the connection between the quote-unquote war on terror and the blowback that was happening in the UK. We haven't heard that as clearly in France. We haven't heard it at all, really, in U.S. politics in a big way. And it just makes me think that it speaks to the fact that there is, I think, more potency around that message, which I think is also truthful and fact-based, that oftentimes no one is taking advantage of here on the progressive side of the ledger, at least in Congress in America.
I would agree. I would hope that that's the case here in the United States, and we will have an opportunity to test that out, I suspect, in the midterms. I'm not sure how big a role it played in the UK. I think, obviously, Corbyn's hitting hard on inequality, on the failure of the Conservatives to deliver on economic issues, played a big role. That's on the positive side of the ledger. On the negative side of the ledger, I'd say, unfortunately, Corbyn, you know, moved to the center or even a little bit to the right on immigration issues and really, you know, started borrowing some of the language of the more conservative forces in the UK on, for instance, the virtues of Brexit and keeping folks out and being very careful about who comes into the UK. I think, unfortunately, that also played a role in boosting Labour's chances. It's hard to know if, for instance, Labour had taken a more consistent approach on the negatives of Brexit and really come out strongly in favor of either a soft Brexit or even of reversing the Brexit, whether that would have improved its electoral chances. But again, that's Monday morning quarterbacking.
Mm-hmm. No, it's certainly a fair point, and certainly on policing too, slight move to the right there. I just wanted to raise that because with so many issues sort of roiling around the world in the United States on a foreign policy basis that are to some degree very related to this, I thought just that conversation even becoming a conversation in the UK was interesting to me. A lot going on here on the US side of things. Difficult to say what is going to happen, but it seems that because of whatever the strategy is coming out of the Pentagon, the U.S. and Russia tensions really on a knife's edge there in Syria. I mean, you know, there's an article in the New York Times today by Helene Cooper with the headline that the U.S. is sleepwalking into a wider role inside of Syria. They're referencing, I guess, the thing that's now very popular in the World War I historiography, that the major powers sleptwalked into World War I. But, I mean, do you think that's the case, that the U.S. doesn't have much of a strategy but nevertheless is blundering into deeper and deeper, being deeper and deeper drawn into this situation in Syria?
I think it absolutely is being drawn into the conflict into Syria. Not so much, I would think, in order to go head-to-head with Russia. I think really the issue here is Iran, the Trump administration. If it has a consistent policy at all, it's a policy that's directed at countering Iran's influence in the region and even further potentially changing the regime in Iran. There have been a couple of statements by some NSC personnel about the desire to change the government inside Iran. Rex Tillerson, in remarks in front of Congress, said that regime change was on the table. The question of whether U.S. is sleepwalking or not, I think the choice of the word is interesting because I wouldn't use sleepwalk. I would say it's being walked into the conflict. In other words, Saudi Arabia has been pushing hard for the United States to side with it against Iran. In other words, siding with a rather extreme version of Sunni Islam against Iran's Shia Islam. And so that's the pull from Saudi Arabia. But there's also, I think, a push factor coming from Israel as well. Israel, of course, has long been concerned about Iran's influence in the larger Middle East and is very concerned about the regime in Iran, regardless of whether Hassan Rouhani won in the last elections. It's really focused on the clerical administration. So I would say that the United States, to conclude, is not sleepwalking. It's being kind of gang pressed into the conflict. And its own kind of instincts on this, and Trump has been pushing this even before he was a candidate, is to counter Iran and Iranian influence more generally.
Well, I mean, it does seem that to some degree that, I mean, that sort of single-minded focus on Iran, you know, could have the opposite effect in some ways of backfiring against the Trump regime on so many different levels. I think, honestly, the only thing they're doing right now with this whole thing of promoting these people in Al-Tanf and shooting down these Syrian planes is prolonging the Islamic State, ultimately. I mean, that's what's going on here. And it seems interesting to me, and I'm curious what you think about President Macron sort of switching up now on Hollande and saying that he doesn't think the removal of Assad has to be any sort of precondition to any sort of diplomatic solution, which leans more towards certainly the consensus that the Russians were trying to bring in the Astana talks as they were going, and now to have a major U.S. ally sort of slink into that, I mean, I think sort of is an interesting thing, and I wonder if the U.S. strategy is so single-mindedly focused on one goal that it could in some ways sort of shift the balance of who really are the major players here.
I would agree. You know, before, of course, the single-minded goal was the defeat of the Islamic State, or at least that's what Donald Trump insisted. The expectation by many within the administration, of course, is the Islamic State is already dead, that Mosul is 90 to 95% already in control of the anti-Islamic State factions. The capital at Raqqa is likely to fall. That the Islamic State is shrinking at a rapid clip, and that it soon will be confined to a rather narrow corridor along the Iraq-Syria border. So because the administration's expecting that, it's already shifted its kind of primary goal to focusing on Iran. And that might be premature. A number of analysts who know a great deal more about this than I do say that the Islamic State, you know, can go in a wax wane kind of dynamic for quite some time. You know, it'll concentrate, it'll rally its forces, and then it'll seize more territory, and it'll be forced back, et cetera, et cetera. So the Islamic State, I would say, is far from dead. And even if the Islamic State, qua Islamic State, were to fall, the ideology that inspires the Islamic State would appear in some other form, take some other institutional form sometime in the future. The question really is not so much whether Assad at this point, the leader of Syria, is going to be allowed, so to speak, by France or the United States or Russia to stay on in Syria. I mean, his influence over the state has shrunk as well, regardless of the amount of territory that the Syrian army might control at any given point. Again, it's really, from the Trump administration's point of view, it's really Iran. Iran is the so-called puppet master, and again, far more than Russia, that is the concern and the focus. Will it backfire? Absolutely, it will backfire. You know, it will backfire because everything the United States does to squeeze Iran will diminish the influence of reformist forces within Iran and strengthen the hands of the hardliners, whether they're in the Revolutionary Guard or the clerical establishment or what have you. And that will produce an Iran that is considerably more toxic, considerably more adventurous in the Middle East, and an Iran that is more likely to come head to head or fist to fist, if you will, with the Trump administration.
Yeah, no, well, I think it's there's a lot to be said in there. I mean, it seems like there's also, to me, another kind of logical fallacy in the whole thing. I mean, the whole idea that, well, you don't want the Syrian government and the Iraqi popular mobilization units to be able to sort of link up and create a quote-unquote land bridge by which, you know, however people feel about this, you know, Iran will then transfer weapons to Hezbollah and so on and so forth, beside the fact that most people don't even think that. The land bridge is not even a factor in that. The weapons are getting there anyway, and certainly that wouldn't even be the most effective way. But I think there's even a one level deeper of a logical fallacy, which is that the Iraqi government is a puppet government of Iran, which I think you could say slightly more correctly maybe about Maliki, although I don't think that was true either. But it seems to me that certainly a body in and of himself giving over the control of that highway to some of those U.S. forces, you know, sort of criticizing Iran a little bit in the past week. We've seen the same thing from Muqtada al-Sadr, who's actually become surprisingly highly critical of the Iranian role and what they're playing inside of the country. Iyad Alawi making a lot of statements this past week. So, I mean, it also seems like that's another sort of tricky piece, is Iraq is not really seen as an independent player. Now, it's a player that certainly is prostrate, perhaps, but I don't think it's one that really is a puppet player, as it were.
To throw in yet another dimension, you know, the concerns, at least the expressed concerns from Saudi Arabia, Israel, the United States, is that Iran is a supreme puppet master supplying arms, trying to achieve its geopolitical ambitions in the region through military and extremist fashion, spreading its extremist Shia ideology. But to be honest, I think what their real concern is not so much the militarist Iran, but it's actually the reformist Iran. It's an Iran that is economically a powerhouse in the region, Iran with an extremely sophisticated middle class, extremely sophisticated business community. In short, an Iran that can dominate the Middle East, not through this kind of combination of religious ideology and militarism, but through much more conventional economic means, simply by being an economic superpower. That, I think, is underlying the concerns. But of course, they can't come out and say that, because that would not motivate Congress or the Knesset to support an extremist anti-Iran coalition. So they have to really emphasize what they consider the more malign aspects of Iranian influence.
No, I think that's certainly a very good point there. Well, sort of swinging back around here to another issue on the other side of the planet, tensions on the Korean Peninsula now certainly much higher. The death of this UVA student, Otto Wambier, I believe his name was, and obviously everything going on with the ballistic missiles, and then Trump's very sort of cryptic statement about how China had tried, but the time was over, or whatever it may be, and then now we're going to have the president of South Korea, I believe, in the United States next week. So it seems like, and he's going to be raising some issues with that and the way that played out in terms of the acceleration issues. So it seems like also, as it concerns Korea, the escalation here is just sort of continuing apace. Your thoughts?
It certainly is. Certainly the escalation of rhetoric, the labeling of North Korea as evil, etc., for its treatment of Otto Wambier. Clearly that is a setback in U.S. Or efforts, a possible diplomatic solution to the standoff between the United States and North Korea. However, despite the fact that, you know, for instance, Chris Hill, who used to be in the Bush administration negotiating on six-party talks, despite the fact that he came out in the New York Times and basically said, you know, that the United States would be justified in going to war with North Korea over Otto Wambier, which I thought was extraordinarily intemperate statement. I don't think the Trump administration really has any intention of launching a preemptive attack. Now, of course, you know, it's an unpredictable regime in Washington, here in Washington, so I can't say with any 100% certitude. But again, you know, the administration conducted a strategic review of North Korea policy and came to the conclusion that war would be devastating. And that's been reflected in James Mattis's statement about North Korea, that any war that the United States would be engaged in would have devastating consequences for our allies and for U.S. soldiers in the region. So I don't think the administration is heading in that direction. There was a recent op-ed from folks over at Heritage. And what did they say about, you know, the current situation? They usually take the most kind of far-right position. They didn't say, let's go to war. They, too, acknowledged that it would be a terrible idea. More sanctions. So I think that's likely to be the default position. China won't be helping us out as much as, you know, the Trump administration anticipated. And sanctions, of course, have had, you know, some effect, but have not, you know, caused a regime change in North Korea or even a change in conduct from the government in Pyongyang. Nevertheless, I think that increased sanctions is probably going to be the default position that the administration settles on.
Well, you know, I'm curious, and I know the South Koreans are going to be pushing next week the return to the six-party talks, China also saying they want to go back to that, and Russia as well, also calling for a resumption. But I don't know. That, to me, almost fall – what's the point? I mean, obviously the reality of the situation is that the U.S. should just, to me, negotiate unilaterally with North Korea and South Korea. I mean, it just seems that to the end of the day, the six-party talks are going to rise and they're going to fall on whether the United States is going to be willing to make any sort of concession on the peace treaty issue, on the military exercise issue, and so on and so forth, which they've shown zero appetite to make any move or any change on. So it just seems like it doesn't make a lot of sense to get back around the table in the six-party talks when the main player, quite frankly, is just not going to be willing to deal.
You make an extremely good point. But in general, at least with the previous six-party talks, it wasn't an either-or. The six-party talks did come with preparatory bilateral negotiations between the United States and North Korea. Those weren't emphasized, and they took place very quietly, but the six-party talks would not have gotten off the ground without those preparatory bilaterals. So I suspect that if we did have some version of a six-party talks return, we would see something similar. We had some 1.5 track discussions that took place in Europe not long ago where the North Koreans did participate. They weren't necessarily all that forthcoming, but then the U.S. wasn't either. So, yeah, I mean, at this point, of course, you know, what we need is some kind of bilateral discussion of where there can be some wiggle room on the central demand of the U.S. to for North Korea to give up all its nukes before any negotiations take place, and North Korea's insistence that it will not give up its nuclear program at all. So there has to be some kind of wiggle room found bilaterally between those two irreconcilable positions. Getting everybody in the room from the other six countries, you know, to be honest, it's not entirely a waste of time, in part because any opportunity for Russia, China, the United States, Japan, South Korea to get together, whether North Korea is there or not, is useful, you know, because there's precious few opportunities for any kind of discussion of security matters in Northeast Asia. There is no formal mechanism as there is in Southeast Asia or in many other parts of the world. It's kind of a negotiations black hole. So any opportunity, from my point of view, is a plus.
Yeah, well, and certainly the not having it be an either or is very interesting on a lot of levels. I'll be very interested to see if there is any sort of movement or possibility of a summit between President Moon and Kim Jong-un on the Korean Peninsula, which I actually think could be a huge game changer in the overall situation. But be that as it may, a lot of different issues to talk about. We could keep going all day on this, but unfortunately we don't have time. John Pfeffer, the co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies, also an author. I know you got a new play coming out very soon, Paper, so we'll have to get you back on here, maybe in a cultural capacity, John. But thank you so much for joining us here today. And we are going to end the show here on that note on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. See you next time.
By Any Means Necessary.